He saw the look of a peculiar panic growing in her eyes. It was not the look of understanding, but of a ferocious refusal to understand, as if she wanted to turn the violence of her emotion into a fog screen, as if she hoped not that it would blind her to reality, but that her blindness would make reality cease to exist. "But I have the right to demand it. I own your life. It's my property by your own oath. You swore to serve my happiness. Not yours, mine. What have you done for me? You've given me nothing. You've sacrificed nothing. You've never been concerned with anything but yourself, your work, your mills, your talent, your mistress. What about me? I hold first claim. I'm presenting it for collection. You're the account I own." It was the look on his face that drove her up the rising steps of her voice, scream by scream, into terror. She was seeing not anger or pain or guilt, but the one inviolate enemy, indifference. "Have you thought of me?" she screamed, her voice breaking against his face. "Have you thought of what you're doing to me? You have no right to go on if you know that you're putting me through hell every time you sleep with that woman. I can't stand it. I can't stand one moment of knowing it. Will you sacrifice me to your animal desire? Are you as vicious and selfish as that? Can you buy your pleasure at the price of my suffering? Can you have it if this is what it does to me?" Feeling nothing but the emptiness of wonder, he observed the thing which he had glimpsed briefly in the past and was now seeing in the full ugliness of its futility, the spectacle of pleas for pity, delivered in snarling hatred, as threats and as demands. "Lillian," he said very quietly, "I would have it, even if it took your life." She heard it. She heard more than he was ready to know and to hear in his own words. The shock to him was that she did not scream in answer, but that he saw her instead shrinking down into calm. "You have no right," she said dully. It had the embarrassing helplessness of the words of a person who knows her own words to be meaningless. "Whatever claim you may have on me," he said, "no human being can hold on another a claim demanding that he wipe himself out of existence."
"Does she mean as much as that to you?"
"Much more than that." The look of thought was returning to her face, but in her face it had the quality of a look of cunning. She remained silent. "Lillian, I'm glad that you know the truth. Now you can make a choice with full understanding. You may divorce me, or you may ask that we continue as we are. That is the only choice you have. It is all I can offer you. I think you know I want you to divorce me, but I don't ask for sacrifices. I don't know what sort of comfort you can find in our marriage, but if you do, I won't ask you to give it up. I don't know why you should want to hold me now. I don't know what it is that I mean to you. I don't know what you're seeking, what form of happiness is yours, or what you will obtain from a situation which I see as intolerable for both of us. By every standard of mine, you should have divorced me long ago. By every standard of mine, to maintain our marriage will be a vicious fraud. But my standards are not yours. I do not understand yours, I never have, but I will accept them. If this is the manner of your love for me, if bearing the name of my wife will give you some form of contentment, I won't take it away from you. It's I who've broken my word, so I will atone for it to the extent I can. You know, of course, that I could buy one of those modern judges and obtain a divorce any time I wished. I won't do it. I will keep my word if you so desire. But this is the only form in which I can keep it. Now make your choice. But if you choose to hold me, you must never speak to me about her. You must never show her that you know if you meet her in the future. You must never touch that part of my life." She stood still, looking up at him, the posture of her body slouched and loose, as if its sloppiness were a form of defiance, as if she did not care to resume, for his sake, the discipline of a graceful bearing. "Miss Dagny Taggart," she said, and chuckled, the superwoman, whom common average wives were not supposed to suspect, the woman who cared for nothing but business and dealt with men as a man, the woman of great spirit who admired you platonically just for your genius, your mills, and your metal, she chuckled. "I should have known that she was just a bitch who wanted you in the same way as any bitch would want you, because you are fully as expert in bed as you are at a desk, if I'm a judge of such matters. But she would appreciate that better than I, since she worships expertness of any kind, and since she has probably been laid by every section hand on a railroad." She stopped, because she saw for the first time in her life by what sort of look one learns that a man is capable of killing. But he was not looking at her. She was not sure whether he was seeing her at all or hearing her voice. He was hearing his own voice, saying her words, saying them to Dagny in the sun-striped bedroom of Ellis Wyatt's house. He was seeing in the nights behind him Dagny's face in those moments when, his body leaving hers, she lay still with a look of radiance that was more than a smile, a look of youth, of early morning, of gratitude to the fact of one's own existence. And he was seeing Lillian's face, as he had seen it in bed beside him, a lifeless face with evasive eyes, with some feeble sneer on its lips and the look of sharing some smutty guilt. He saw who was the accuser and who the accused. He saw the obscenity of letting impotence hold itself as virtue and damn the power of living as a sin. He saw with the clarity of direct perception, in the shock of a single instant, the terrible ugliness of that which had once been his own belief. It was only an instant, a conviction without words, a knowledge grasped as a feeling left unsealed by his mind. The shock brought him back to the sight of Lillian and to the sound of her words. She appeared to him suddenly as some inconsequential presence that had to be dealt with at the moment. "Lillian," he said, in an unstressed voice that did not grant her even the honor of anger, "you are not to speak of her to me. If you ever do it again, I will answer you as I would answer a hoodlum. I will beat you up. Neither you nor anyone else is to discuss her." She glanced at him.
"Really?" she said. It had an odd casual sound, as if the word were tossed away, leaving some hook implanted in her mind.
She seemed to be considering some sudden vision of her own. He said quietly, in weary astonishment, "I thought you would be glad to discover the truth. I thought you would prefer to know, for the sake of whatever love or respect you felt for me, that if I betrayed you, it was not cheaply and casually, it was not for a chorus girl, but for the cleanest and most serious feeling of my life." The ferocious spring with which she whirled to him was involuntary, as was the naked twist of hatred in her face.
"Oh, you goddamn fool!"
He remained silent. Her composure returned with the faint suggestion of a smile of secret mockery.
"I believe you're waiting for my answer," she said. "No, I won't divorce you. Don't ever hope for that. We shall continue as we are, if that is what you offered, and if you think it can continue. See whether you can flout all moral principles and get away with it."
He did not listen to her while she reached for her coat, telling him that she was going back to their home. He barely noticed it when the door closed after her. He stood motionless, held by a feeling he had never experienced before. He knew that he would have to think later, to think and understand. But for the moment he wanted nothing but to observe the wonder of what he felt. It was a sense of freedom, as if he stood alone in the midst of an endless sweep of clean air with only the memory of some weight that had been torn off his shoulders. It was the feeling of an immense deliverance. It was the knowledge that it did not matter to him what Lillian felt, what she suffered, or what became of her. And more, not only that it did not matter, but the shining, guiltless knowledge that it did not have to matter.